Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
What is it with those state house legislators in Columbus and their desperate need for more tax cuts? One of the things we'll be talking about on This Week in the CLE, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I'm Chris Quinn, here with our chief political correspondent, Seth Richardson, as well as our colleagues, Laura Johnston and Jane Cahoon. It's Wednesday already. Short week. Happy Wednesday.
Happy Wednesday.
2 days from Friday.
Yeah, it's you have the Monday off and then you get to the weekend quickly. It's a great way to start summer. Let's start. What are Ohio's Republican state senators thinking in creating a budget that threatens to derail billions of stimulus dollars that are supposed to come to Ohio? Jane Cahoon, I am just befuddled by the repeated insistence of the state house legislators to crowbar tax cuts into the budget when nobody's asking for them and state departments are so lean they're breaking down, like the health department and unemployment. But this one actually does threaten to cost us billions of dollars. What's behind this?
Chris, you just don't get it here. We're putting money back in the pockets of Ohio citizens. But you're right. Ohio Republican lawmakers just can't get enough of tax cuts. They can't seem to draft a budget without them. So when the Senate leaders unveiled their version of the state budget on Tuesday, they included this 5% income tax cut that's going to cost the state $874 million. So that's more than the $380 million in income tax cuts that the House proposed. So it's going to cost, you know, more than double there. But it's also, as you said, it's going to set up a showdown with the Biden administration because the stimulus package, as you said, is sending mucho dollars to the state, but they're not supposed to use that for tax cuts. And we already have Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost, who's also a Republican, like the majority of the legislature. He's already sued over the American Rescue Plan rules that prohibit the money from being used for tax cuts. But, you know, the argument here is they want to put this money back in people's pockets. It's a good line, you know, but as people like Policy Matters of Ohio, for example, point out, you know, it doesn't really give that much money to people, especially at the low end of the income scale. I mean, people who make below a certain amount don't even get taxed in the first place, so it's not going to affect them. And you know, you might recall Rich Exner figured this out when the House proposed the cuts, that they'd be like enough for maybe one nice dinner out or something. So even though they've increased them, I doubt that it's going to be a significant chunk of change for people, for lower income people, or even maybe the average taxpayers.
So think about, though, if you didn't do that and you put that 800 plus million into updating the unemployment department computers, which are decades old now, or almost two decades old, and we saw in the pandemic completely broken down. It just doesn't make sense. Let's give people an extra dinner, or let's make sure we can serve people. You know, as for the Yost thing, the court precedents were pretty clear that the federal government has the ability to do what it's doing. So if they do this, it could cost us, what is it, $3.6 billion that the state was getting from the stimulus? It's really stupid. And it's just like, you're going to give people a couple of extra nice dinners and risk one-time money that could be transformational that we were going to use to put in broadband. So it's really, really kind of dumb.
Well, do make the point, like the Manufacturers Association made the point that this 5% tax cut would benefit small and mid-sized employers who pay their taxes on business income through the owner's individual income taxes. So that's critical to maintaining competitiveness of manufacturing, et cetera. But, you know, I mean, as you said, you know, aside from the legal wrangling and the differences of opinion on the value of these tax cuts, the loss of revenue, as you said, is means that they've got to cut somewhere else. So they did that, including just deep sixing a major expansion of broadband that was supposed to serve rural and underserved areas. You know, Mike DeWine had asked the General Assembly for like $250 million for that. And Senate President Matt Huffman just was really dismissive about it. He's like, I think it's a bad idea to just start spending without a plan. He didn't think they planned it out enough. But that's just one example of something that they just got rid of, you know.
I think that there is a motive for why they keep cutting the taxes. I think they are trying to starve the state government of needed upgrades to deprive certain people of services. I think that the Republicans in the legislature are probably glad that the unemployment system failed so badly, because why should we be helping unemployed people?
The public health system. How many times have we written about all the deficiencies that they faced gathering data and, you know, their antiquated computer system and all the problems, you know, that this pandemic just brought into clear view?
Instead of taking that money and putting it into that, they're saying we're going to give it back to audience. I guess one of the biggest disappointments in this is that Matt Dolan is a leader of it. I mean, here's a guy that we've talked about could be an interesting candidate for Senate because he would stand apart from all the Trump sycophants. But he's the leader of this nonsense.
Yeah, he chairs the Finance Committee.
And he's pushing the tax cuts, and our tax cut is bigger than the House. It's just this is childish nonsense. So you do have to question the motive, and I do think what is rising is the motive is they're trying to stick it to people. They're trying to stick it to the unemployed. They're trying to stick it to the health department because they didn't like how it tried to handle the pandemic, and by starving them of necessary dollars, it cripples their ability to serve. Let's hope that this thing goes through some changes before it.
There's a whole school funding element to this too, which we didn't even go into, which we don't have to, but you know, they changed that as well, you know.
You could see there's a logic in that. The House version would have raised it to, 7,000 per student per year over years, but it would have committed future legislatures to spending they didn't vote
right.
on.
Right, so this one doesn't commit them to that, and it provides a little over 6,000 per student with more for special ed and English language learners. And so, they claim their plan is more sustainable in that regard, although it's overall less than the House, although initially it's a bigger boost.
Yeah, and we'll have to see how they reconcile it. But it was a disappointment to see the obsession with the tax cut once again, especially if it costs us the billions of dollars in stimulus, which I Dave Yost aside, it very well could. It's they're crazy flirting with that because of what that money can be used for. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. What's different today compared to yesterday? With the lifting of nearly all the coronavirus restrictions that have been in place, Laura Johnston, we've lived with some form of restriction for 15, 16 months now, but we got up this morning to pretty much no more restrictions. How is today different than yesterday?
Don't you feel the freedom in the air? I mean, it's totally different. I went swimming at our rec center pool, and all the lockers are open and the showers are open. And, people who are not vaccinated are still supposed to wear masks, but you can just feel this opening up all over the place. My church removed all the ribbons blocking off the pews. It had to been that one out of every three was open. They put the water back in the holy fonts. I had joked that a good name for a pandemic memoir, if you were like religious, would be hand sanitizer instead of holy water. But I think the sanitizer is still there. In our little league, volunteers are now cooking burgers and hot dogs since there's no more space restrictions in the kitchens. And everything can be at full capacity. You can stand up at a bar. You don't have to be seated 6 feet from somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how fast things do return to normal. Will people go into restaurants where the tables are all back to their normal spacing, like at a barrio where everybody's crammed in closely? Or will people still favor outside and just try and keep the healthy air? But it is nice to know that we are rid of all of the restrictions, and that it's all come down to now it's up to you as to what you do.
It's kind of crazy. Like, I mean, this has been 14 months, and so it became the norm, right? I mean, I wrote a piece a little while ago about like transitioning back into society and no longer having to step on the sticker that says stand here in line. And I think there it's going to be a transition for, you know, it's a whole gamut how we feel about that. But I think it does feel really nice to know that it's your choice and that you're, you know, if you're vaccinated, you're safe. And I don't know, I'd love to hear how Jane and Seth feel about this too.
Well, I think, you know, we should stress that that businesses and so forth still have a choice.
True.
And they might be, you know, they might be providing social distance still or partitions or whatever. So I guess it's nice that they have that freedom. I'm still feeling a little cautious, you know, but we're supposed to go to the ballpark today, but it's going to rain pretty badly. So I don't know what the deal is. Like it's going to ruin, you know, Progressive Field's like, oh, big, you know, debut at full capacity.
Well, but they're not, the Indians aren't going back full time till
next week.
11th. Right. Yeah. So that's when they're having the grand reopening and they'll start off.
I know, but it's full capacity today.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Today's the day, but they're having like some sort of ceremony next week.
Right. That's their kind of, you know, yeah, kickoff to, but as of today, they, you know, full house.
I wonder how long it'll be. The remnants of those stickers on the floor in some stores are there. I mean, yeah. You know, 15 years from now, you could see some kid saying, what's that sticker on the floor?
When is that?
Well, you know, one thing I kind of wonder is that, you know, over the past year and a half, there have been, you know, great strides in kind of making these convenience models so that people could operate while still, you know, staying in their homes. And I do sort of wonder if, you know, are we just going to abandon some of those convenience models and some of those things that, hey, we know are smart? Like, you know, you look at the flu cases that, you know, haven't happened really, right? Because we've had, you know, I think less than 200 flu hospitalizations where we're normally in the thousands. Is that going to normalize, you know, more mask wearing, you know, during flu season and stuff like that? It's, I do wonder, like, what are the lessons from this, you know, eight months from now, a year, whatever, like, do we keep some of those measures of convenience and some of those measures of safety? That's one of the things I wonder. I also learned during this time, like, how easy it really is to survive without having to, you know, go out to restaurants and whatnot. I don't know that I'm necessarily aching to go back to crowded restaurants myself, not for any health reasons, just because, you know, I learned I didn't matter.
I don't know. I'm done with masks. And I already got sick right after the pandemic. So forget that. I don't have to avoid getting the common cold because it took me out. All that stuff for me, I'm glad it's over as much as it is. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. What did we learn from a question and answer session with Nina Turner in the first of several candidate profiles that Seth is publishing in the battle to represent Ohio's 11th congressional district in Congress? Seth Richardson, that is, our chief political writer. Seth, what did you learn? What did you find from your question and answer with Nina Turner? And you've also published one with challenger Chantel Brown. We should talk about that as well.
Yeah, we'll have, you know, six of these coming out. Obviously, two of them are already out, but wanted to talk to the candidates who have been out there campaigning the most, because one of the things that I found while I was doing coverage is you can go to these forums and you can watch these forums, but anytime you start getting more than really three people on stage, but even more than two people on stage, the answers just get so diluted that you don't really, you know, it's all kind of quick 30-second sound bites. You ask someone what they're going to do about healthcare in America, and they've got, you know, basically the length of time for a commercial to answer it. That doesn't really behoove anybody. So, you know, I did learn a lot from really all of these interviews. And I think, you know, aside from the, you know, I covered a lot of policy topics in here, but one of the more illuminating things, and we sort of talked about this offline, is looking at how people answered the questions and seeing who was kind of prepared for some of the curveballs that I might have thrown, or you know, who kind of thought on their feet and how they thought on their feet. That was some of the more illuminating stuff to me.
And how do you compare the Nina Turner to the Chantel Brown? I felt like it, just in looking at them, that Nina's was far more substantive, that Chantel's answers were much more shallow.
There certainly did seem to be more, canned answers, so to speak, in some of Chantel's answers, which isn't totally surprising, right? But I could definitely tell who was able to sort of go off script a little better than the other. I do think Nina probably outperformed Chantel in that regard a little bit. One of the more surprising things to me, and I guess it shouldn't be surprising, but I was hoping to get this out of some of the candidates, is because, you know, Marsha Fudge is still such a presence here, right? And it's her seat, and she was, you know, really beloved by the district. But I wanted to ask everybody, you know, what they thought, you know, her greatest success and her greatest failure was. You know, everybody pretty much by and large had an answer for the greatest success, but nobody wanted to touch what they viewed as a failure. Nobody at all. The other question that I really enjoyed asking the candidates was what their greatest weakness was. Because, you know, every candidate wants to talk about their strengths. I can win because of this. I can win because of this, yada, yada. But nobody ever talks about their weaknesses. So it is interesting to hear kind of where they think their weak spots are. And one of the more interesting things when you look at the Chantel and the Nina Turner interview is Nina didn't spend any time attacking any other candidates overtly or covertly, however you want to look at it. If you look at, and it's not just Chantel Brown's interview, there's going to be some others that come out where you do see some of those lines and whatnot, where people kind of have knives out, right? And I guess that is sort of a function of running from behind.
Right. I mean, I think that's the clear sign that this is a runaway. This has felt like a runaway since day one, that Nina Turner was going to win this big. And I know we don't do stories on when the candidates do their own polls, but she did do one that shows it is a runaway, that she is slaughtering everybody. So I'm not surprised that she isn't criticizing the others, because she doesn't need to. She has a platform to stand on. She has a history that is rich with legislative work. She's done stuff. And she's just a force of nature, whereas the rest of these folks don't have that. And I mean, I think this was over from day one. We'll have to see how it goes. But it's not. So I love your knives out analogy, because that's the only way they can try and get ahead, is to try and take her down. But good luck with that. It's this week in the CLE. Why are some Ohio Democrats in Congress all a flutter to stop the awarding of a $6 billion contract to a Wisconsin company for replacing the Postal Service's mail delivery fleet? Jane Cahoon, I noticed part of the objection here is that not enough of it would be electric vehicles, but I wonder if that's actually a smart thing, because the electric vehicles do have some limitations.
Well, they do. And yes, this is a major concern of Sherrod Brown, Tim Ryan, and Marcy Kaptur. They wonder how this jibes with the Biden administration's pledge to replace, fleets, you know, to make them all electric, because this would be like only 10%. But the other thing is, they suggested there might have been some political influence in the way this huge contract was awarded. So they've asked President Biden to delay this 10-year contract with Oshkosh Defense until it can be reviewed, to make sure nothing inappropriate or there was no, you know, inappropriate political influence exerted. So what this is about is, it's for 165,000, or up to 165,000, what they call next generation delivery vehicles for the Postal Service. So, you know, the current fleet has like more than 230,000 vehicles, and that, you know, a lot of them deliver mail 6 and often 7 days a week. A lot of them have been in service for 30 years, and they've got, you know, bad heating and air conditioning and no airbags. They get like 10 miles per gallon. So this is what the contract is all about. But if you recall, the Postmaster General is Louis DeJoy, and he was named under Trump. So the Democrats do not like him at all. Just think back to when we had the election and the mail-in ballots and all the slowdowns at the Postal Service they put at his feet. But the other, as I said, intriguing part of this is that there was some sort of big $54 million stock trade made the day before DeJoy announced this contract award. And the parties who engaged in that haven't been revealed. So it's kind of mysterious, but you know, they, Tim Ryan is particularly concerned about this because his district includes Lordstown Motors, the electric vehicle company, which is part owned by Workhorse, which would have gotten extra business if Workhorse got this contract. So, but anyway, they're all, as you said, up in arms about this. They want it delayed. And, you know, interestingly, as far as DeJoy goes, I think Biden's kind of trying to ease him out of there by naming new people to the Postal Service Board of Governors, but that hasn't really happened yet.
The idea that the entire fleet should be electric or emission-free does raise some questions because the technology for that isn't really there yet. I mean, you know, there have been a lot of stories done in the past week about the Ford F-150 electric vehicle, which Ford has made a big announcement about. It gets 300 miles, but when you load that thing down, it might not even get 100 miles. And going short distances isn't going to suffice. I mean, we've been wondering what happens if you have an electric vehicle and you want to go to North Carolina. Do you have to stop every 300 miles or less and spend an hour getting your vehicle charged? What, post office vehicles are loaded heavily with stuff to deliver. So how many miles?
They go into some challenging areas too, you know, that might not be suitable for an electric vehicle.
So has anybody done a study in the Postal Service about what their actual needs are before they just say, we're going to convert to all electric? I mean, it's a great mission for the president to put out there, but before you go awarding a contract for the next 20 years, shouldn't you figure that kind of stuff out? So I hope they take a step back and look at it, but not exactly for the reasons that the Democrats for Ohio are saying. Do you really want to buy a fleet of vehicles that doesn't do the job? It would be one of the classic miscues in history. So, all right, you're listening to This Week in the CLE. Did Cuyahoga County Prosecutor Michael O'Malley consider the cost in time, effort, and jury angst when he decided to seek the death penalty in the killing of an undercover police detective, especially when no one is being executed in Ohio these days? Laura Johnston, what was Mike O'Malley thinking here? It's a cop killing, so you have to go for a death penalty?
I guess so. I mean, I don't know exactly how much thought he put into this. I mean, David McDaniel has no criminal history as an adult or juvenile, according to court records. As far as we know, he didn't know that the detective was a cop when he shot him. He was 18 at the time of this shooting. And there's a couple other juveniles charged in this. So far this year, McDaniel is the first person to be indicted on charges that carry a potential death sentence. But yeah, we haven't put anyone to death in the state in a while. And Mike DeWine's made it pretty clear that he's not going to be doing it while he is governor. So, yeah, you have to wonder, why put everyone through that?
We in the Anthony Sowell case, we know how much it cost. Leila Tassi added up the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars that it took to go through the death penalty phase. And then he died of natural causes 10 years later. It was all for nothing. We wouldn't have had to do it at all. If he would have been sentenced to life in prison, we would have had the same outcome. He would have died 10 years later of natural causes. The state can't get the drugs to kill people, right? We have a governor who has no interest in signing death warrants. So why do it? And the thing is, I ask about the jury angst. The jurors who go through death penalty cases, it tears them up inside. I mean, it's a hard thing to do. Why put people through that when you don't have a need for it? If the real outcome of this is likely to be this guy, if he's guilty, being imprisoned for life, why not go that route, save the money, save the time, and spare the jurors the trauma?
I think it's a really legitimate question to ask and one we should be thinking about as a society. I mean, Cuyahoga County has long been the state's most prolific seeker of the death penalty. And there was a study that came out, I believe John Coniglia wrote about it earlier this year, that basically said the counties that have the most death penalty trials just keep doing the most. I mean, they have a population that is accepting of that. They have the money to prosecute it. And so they just keep doing it. But it'd be nice to take a step back and be like, look, are we doing the right thing here? Is this the best use of anyone's time and money? Because you're right. The number of, it's not just the trial and the angst. It's every trial that comes after that, or every hearing that they have, every time they bring it back. And you know, you get to exhaust a lot of appeals on a death penalty case.
The other thing is it's a cop killing, so that mm-hmm. has the but the but it was an undercover police officer, so the people who did the killing did not know that it was a police officer, which changes that dynamic a little bit. It's an easy thing for Michael Maui to do. I'm going for the death penalty, right? Who's going to criticize that except maybe us? But but you would think that at some point a prosecutor somewhere would sit back and say, what's in the best interest of society here? Is it in the best interest to spend tons of tax money and put people through hell for an outcome that's not going to be different than if I just went through and tried to put them away for life? Yeah, part of it is they say this to get a plea deal, but that's not really an honest way of going about business either. I'll spare your life if you plead guilty and spare us the whole trial. It feels a little icky that you would use death as the bargaining chip. So, you're listening to This Week in the CLE. Was the bump in vaccinations we saw after Governor Mike DeWine announced his Vax-a-Million drawing short-lived? Don't we still have $4 million to give away? Seth Richardson will find out who the new winner is tonight, so maybe I won't be talking to one of you tomorrow. I was going to say the same things.
So the really elevated level of vaccinations that we saw started has definitely tapered off, but I guess it sort of depends on how you look at it, right? So, Evan McDonald had a story yesterday that Ohio started 128,000 vaccines over the previous 7-day period ending Sunday, far below the previous two periods, since DeWine announced the Vax-a-Million program. Those were at 188,000 and 147,000. But it is still slightly up over the 118,000 that they started just before they announced this. So I think there was, just kind of using some common sense here, I think there was always going to be a pretty big rush in the beginning, and then you kind of, level off a little bit. The question is, are those, 75, 80,000 extra vaccinations that we saw worth the $5 million that they're giving away, plus the scholarships?
Probably, if you think about the other things they've done to get people vaccinated, it didn't work. At least they got a bump. I was a little bit surprised it was a 1-week bump. I thought the publicity of the two people who won last week would persuade even more people to go in and want to get a piece of that.
I kind of thought it would be the same too, but I mean, even DeWine kind of admitted that, this is supposed to get people who already plan to get the vaccine, but maybe hadn't gotten around to it, to go out and get it, right? So that seems to maybe have worked a little bit.
Can I jump in? Yeah, go ahead, Jane. Go ahead.
Apparently, we have heard from the governor's office since this story was published, and they want to push back a little bit and present us with some other data points that might be age breakdown or something like that that show maybe. There is a bump in some areas, but I have no idea what they're, you can make numbers say a lot of different things.
Yeah, they're playing with their abacus again.
Just want to put that out there that they want to show us some other data points.
They're going to show that, I bet, that the 12-year-olds and above were getting vaccinated in higher numbers. But let's remember, they just became eligible. Yeah. So you can't say the Vax-a-Million program push them in. They may have been wanting to get in all along. You can't play with the numbers. The total numbers are what we're looking at, and the bump went down. I do wonder if the fact that this week that we're counting included 2 days of the holiday weekend may have depressed it. I don't think most people on Memorial Day weekend are thinking, I got to go get vaccinated. I think they're thinking it's summer at last and I want to enjoy the weekend. Maybe we'll see a rise again this weekend when it's not so much the holiday.
That was one thing I was wondering too, because who wants to go get a shot on your long weekend when you could be out? It was beautiful this weekend too. So who wants to, go spend it at a doctor's office getting a shot in your arm? I completely understand that. So yeah, it will be, with just kind of a regular 7 days, so to speak, if it'll tick up a little bit. I don't know. I mean, but again, like kind of the root question of all this is, how better would that $5 million have been spent, getting the vaccine effort out? Was another PSA really going to do the trick? We've seen so many of those.
Yeah, no, actually, I think you can call the Vax-a-Million an unqualified success. It got a lot of attention on the vaccine. It got a lot of people to go. It created a national model. All the states are doing it.
Every state is copying it.
Although I saw West Virginia is giving out
guns.
Right.
Like, what are they thinking? Get a shot. We'll give you a gun. It's like, I thought we were trying to save lives here.
Two shots anyway. For the price of one.
Oh, Shane.
All right. We'll end it there. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Thank you, Seth. Thank you, Laura. And thank you, the witty Jane Cahoon. Thanks to everybody who listens to this podcast. We will be back tomorrow.